Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is June the 17th, and we are in Parshas Bahar. We are on page 702, and we have the Pasuk Lamed Tes, verse 39.
Listen to the previous one, or do you remember?
No.
Do you listen to the class before to remember where we are?
I actually did listen to it a little bit.
Just
I did. Yeah.
Curious.
Yeah, it depends on the. Okay. V'chiyamu chachicha imach v'nim karlach, and if your brother shall become impoverished with you and be sold to you, lo savod ba'avodas aved, do not work him the working of a slave. Now this is referring to a Jewish slave, someone who is sold to you, who is a Jew. So they become an Eved Ivri. A Jewish slave, we learned about an Eved Ivri already back in Parshas Mishpatim, and here we'll learn about it a little more. So you're not allowed to work him like a slave. Rather, Kisachir Kisoshav Yeimach, he shall be with you, it says here, like a laborer or a resident. Adshnas Hayovel Yavon Imach, he works with you until the year of Yovel. So that means that he is going to work for you the same way your employee would work for you. That's the way you can work him. Now obviously you don't pay him. He does not get paid wages because he's your slave. But you can't make him do menial work. He can only work as an employee. That's the way you treat him. And he works with you until Yovel. Now, we already learned back in Parshas Mishpatim that an Eved Ivri works for 6 years. It's only if he becomes a Nirtza, he has his ear pierced, then he works until Yovel. But here we learn something else, which is that if Yovel falls during his 6-year tenure, so then he goes free at Yovel, even though he's only worked, let's say, 3 years. Doesn't matter. If that's when Yovel comes, then that's when he goes free. So when you're within 6 years of Yovel, all slaves go free at Yovel, irrespective of when they started.
If he doesn't want to go free and has his ears pierced, is he then like a slave laborer, or is he still an employee?
No, he's still an employee, still treated like an employee, an unpaid employee, of course.
Yeah.
The only thing is that once Yovel comes, he can't stay any longer. That the only way to stay past 6 years is if Yovel has not yet come. Then he can get his ear pierced and stay till Yovel. Pasuk Mem Aleph, verse 41, V'yatzame imach, he shall leave you, hu uvanav imo, he and his sons with him, meaning, when he leaves your workforce, your slave workforce, then his sons leave as well, which begs the question, when were his sons ever slaves that they need to leave? Only he's your slave, not his sons. And from here is one of the places where we understand that the master is required to support the children of the slave. When you buy an Eved Ivri, when you buy a Jewish slave, you are now required to give parnasa to his children, and therefore when he leaves, his children leave.
Those are children that are born while he's a slave.
No, or children from his
family.
Jewish wife, that from his original family.
But they don't care about supporting the Jewish wife.
No, she also has to be. Here it doesn't say it, but in Mishpatim it says it.
Okay.
He has to support the wife and the children. Yeah. V'shavel mishpachto, he goes back to his family. V'alachuzas avosav yashuv, and he also returns to they translate it here as to the ancestral heritage. He goes back to his ancestral heritage, which means he gets whatever positions he had back. Whatever kavod, whatever honor his family enjoyed before he became a slave, he would go back to that honor. It can't be held against him that he spent some time as a Jewish slave. Ki avadayhem, for they are my slaves, says Hashem. Hashem says, all the Jews are my slaves. They're not your slaves, they're my slaves. They serve me. I took them out of Egypt. As Rashi says, Shtarai Kodem, my contract precedes your contract. You bought him now. I bought him a long time ago. All Jews are mine. When I took them out of Egypt, they became my slaves. Therefore, lo yimachrum mimkeres avad, they may not be sold as slaves, which means you're not allowed to put them on the, what do they call it? The selling block. You can't put Jewish would-be slaves up on a on a platform and make an announcement, Jews for sale as slaves. Can't do that. It's usur to do that. Lo yimachrum mimkeres avad, you may not sell them the sale of slaves. Lo sir devo befarech, do not work him with perech. Now, what is perech? We know that in Mitzrayim we were worked with avodas perech. Avodas perech literally means back-breaking labor. You're not allowed to work him with back-breaking labor. But it doesn't only mean that. It can also mean work that does not have a clear purpose. So sometimes with a slave who you don't have any work for the slave right now, you don't want the slave to become complacent or to feel like they can just laze around. So you give them work, busy work. You're not allowed to give your Jewish slave busy work. It's either real work or no work. Yeah.
God keeps mentioning that you shall fear me, you shall listen to me. Why is that?
Okay, so the rest of the pasuk is V'yareisam Elokecha, you should fear your God.
Yeah.
So whenever it says V'yareisam Elokecha, you should fear your God, it means that, or I shouldn't say whatever, most of the time it means we're talking about something which you could do it and people won't realize that you're doing something wrong. Only Hashem knows. So in this case, for example, you're not allowed to give him busy work. Who knows whether it's busy work or not? I tell him, I'd like you to boil up a pot of coffee. Now, I don't really need any coffee. I'm just doing it to keep him busy. But nobody knows that. Maybe I do want a cup of coffee. So it's not clear. So v'yareisam Elokecha, fear your God, because Hashem knows whether you're just giving him busy work or whether the work is really needed. Answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there a different Hebrew word for slave and for servant?
There is not a different Hebrew word for slave or servant.
Right. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Strange.
Yeah. In English, we servant is kind of like a downgraded slave, but it's the a slave is a slave over here. Slave means an unpaid laborer. That's a slave. An unpaid laborer who cannot quit.
Yeah, and a servant is someone that you pay, isn't it? Someone you hire.
Yeah. So here it's a slave. He doesn't get paid, and he can't quit.
Anyway, there's no different Hebrew word.
No.
Sometimes it's translated.
Yeah, I don't know why. Okay. Yeah, I don't know why they do that. Okay, so now let's pause here for a moment. So we'll continue in a few minutes. But so now we're discussing here a Jewish slave. Now we're talking about a man. We're not talking about a woman, because a Jewish female slave, there is no such thing as an adult Jewish female slave. The only type of female Jewish slave that we have in the Torah is one who is young, who is under the age of majority. She's got to be under bas mitzvah. And that at that age, she can be sold only by her father. There's no other way for her to become a Jewish female slave. It's only if her father sells her. And as we learned back in Parashas Mishpatim, that was really an attempt for a poor person to get his daughter married off. That was really what it was, because there's a concept of yi'ud. Yi'ud is that the person who purchases her, that purchase money actually turns into marriage money, and he ends up marrying her. That's the goal of an amma ivriya, of a Jewish female slave, which is a completely different concept than actual slavery. An adult Jew to be sold into slavery can only be male. And there's two ways it can happen. Either he sells himself into slavery because he's destitute. He has no way of supporting his family. So he sells himself into slavery, which, first of all, means that he's guaranteed three meals a day, but also his family are guaranteed three meals a day, because the master has to now support the wife and children. But in addition to that, a man could be sold into slavery for stealing money and not being able to pay back. If a man steals money and cannot pay back, then he is sold into slavery. Those are the two ways it can happen. So either he sells himself, or Beis Din sells him because he needs a way of paying back for his theft. Only theft, meaning, let's say he damages property, and he has no money to pay for the damaged property, he cannot be sold into slavery for that. He goes into debt, but he cannot be sold into slavery. Slavery is only for theft. He steals money, and then he spends it, and he can't pay back, so then he can be sold into slavery. So we're only talking about those two scenarios, where a man sells himself, or he is sold because he is a thief, and he can't pay back. In those two scenarios, he becomes a slave, and as we already mentioned, slave doesn't mean what often is conjured up in our minds when we think of slavery, because we think of American slavery, and this is not the same thing. This is he appears no different than a regular employee, except he's not drawing a paycheck, and he cannot quit. But other than that, he's working your field the same way your day laborers are working the field. He's threshing the grain, and he's whatever it is your day laborers are doing, he's doing the same thing they are. Just they're drawing a paycheck and he's not. And they can quit and he can't. But there's no difference in the way that they're being treated, and there's no difference in the type of work that they're doing. Now there is one more. There is one more form of work that a Jewish slave can do for you. It is not mentioned here in Parshas Bahar. We mentioned it back in Parshas Mishpatim. And that is that you can force him to have an intimate relationship with your non-Jewish female slave in order to produce children which will end up being your slaves, real slaves. Not Jewish slaves, because as we know, if a Jewish man has a relationship with a non-Jewish woman, or a woman non-Jewish slave, then the children follow the mother, and not the father, and they will remain slaves. So you're allowed to use your Eved Ivri, your Jewish slave, to produce more non-Jewish slaves. That's what you're allowed to do. And in that way, he is required to work for you to produce those slaves. Now, this can only be done if the Eved Ivri has a Jewish wife. If he is single, you can't do this. The reason for that should be clear, because then he can really become attached to this non-Jewish slave, because he has no other wife. But this can only be done if he has a wife, then you can require him to do this. Now, we're about to talk about non-Jewish slaves, so I have to reiterate for you what we've already discussed when we talked about non-Jewish slaves back in Parshas Mishpatim. And that is that the term non-Jewish slave, as far as the Torah goes, is really inaccurate. We know that there are Jews and there are non-Jews. Jews are required to keep all 613 mitzvot of the Torah. Non-Jews are required to keep seven laws. We know that difference. A Jew who becomes a slave is required to keep all 613 mitzvot. His obligations do not change just because he became a slave. And the truth is, the term slavery is really not accurate based on how we define the word slavery, because we've learned there are many limitations over here on this quote-unquote slavery. He's a glorified employee who cannot quit and doesn't draw a paycheck. But it's not the type of slavery that we picture. Then there is non-Jewish slavery. Now, non-Jewish slavery that the Torah talks about is not really non-Jewish slavery. It's really the terminology is slavery, eved. In the morning, when you say Shalo Asani Goy, you make a bracha that Hashem did not make you a non-Jew. You also make a bracha Shalo Asani Abed, Hashem did not make me a slave. That's referring to a non-Jewish slave. But isn't that redundant? You already said, I thank you, they didn't make me a non-Jew. So why do I repeat and say they didn't make me a non-Jewish slave? What's the difference? The difference is because a non-Jewish slave is not really not Jewish. A slave that started out as a non-Jew really is an in-between status. And what happens is that, as you know, we do not proselytize in Judaism. We don't seek converts, and in fact, we discourage converts. That's the way we work. With the only type of forcible conversion that we do is with slavery. And that if you buy a non-Jewish slave, you are required to take that slave and put the slave in the mikvah. And it is a forcible conversion. And that slave now becomes not a non-Jew, not a Jew, but a slave. The status is called eved, is slave. And in that status, the slave is now obligated in more than the 7 mitzvos, but less than the full 613. The status that slave has is the same status in terms of how many mitzvos he's required to do as a Jewish woman. Meaning that just as Jewish women are not obligated in time-bound commandments, they are obligated in all non-time-bound commandments, and women are obligated in all prohibitions. But women are not obligated in time-bound commandments, such as sitting in the sukkah or taking the lulav. And even though women can do that, but women are not required to. A slave, meaning a non-Jew who now has become a slave owned by a Jew, becomes obligated in mitzvos the same way a woman is obligated, which means he would not be allowed to eat on Yom Kippur, but he would also not be required to sit in the sukkah, just as a woman. Yeah.
That's a lot of teaching you have to do.
Oh, when yes.
You have a slave.
Yes, yes,
who
yes.
Who would want one?
Right. It would take a lot of work. No question about it. It is a forcible conversion. The slave is forced into the mikvah. If he is a male, then he's forced to go through a circumcision. And through that process, they become a slave. Now, until such time that you go through that process with that slave, the slave is not Jewish. You own a non-Jewish slave. So the Gemara says you have up to a year, meaning if you purchase a non-Jewish slave, which means you go to a non-Jew who owns a slave and purchase a slave from the non-Jew. The other way that a non-Jew becomes a slave is through becoming a prisoner of war. We talked about this back in Parshas Mishpatim. What do you do with your POWs? You win a war, and you capture 10,000 able-bodied men from the enemy. What do you do with those 10,000 able-bodied men? So, what are your choices? Your choices are send them back. If you send them back, all you're doing is rearming
lock
the enemy.
Up.
The other option is lock them up. Then you have 10,000 people who are totally unproductive in society that you now have to feed and clothe and deal with for the rest of their lives. What are you supposed to do with them? So lock them up. We don't believe in locking people up. It doesn't do anything. It's not productive for anybody, not for them and not for us. You can't kill them. They didn't do anything to deserve to be killed. So what do you do with your 10,000 POWs? The answer is?
Work them.
They become slaves.
But sort of Jews.
Excuse me?
Sort of.
Well, for up to a year, they can just be non-Jewish slaves. But within the first year, you are required to forcibly convert them or let them go. You can't keep them for more than a year without forcibly converting them. And then they become a status of slavery. In that state, they remain slaves, and their children are slaves. They could be male or female, and they can marry each other. and produce more slaves. It is such a female that we're talking about that the Jewish slave can be required to have a relationship with her to produce more slaves. If you own a female slave, talking about a non-Jewish female who became your slave, and you have a Jewish slave, you don't have any non-Jewish slaves, so you want more slaves, you can have the Jew have a relationship with the non-Jewish, or the, again, the term non-Jewish is not really true, but the female slave to produce more slaves. The now, this non-Jewish person who became a slave, and now has the status of slave, and was forcibly converted, they remain a slave, and their children remain slaves, until such time that they are set free, which we're about to learn about. If they are ever set free, and it's no guarantee that they will ever be set free, but if they are set free, then they become full-fledged Jews. They can never go back to being not Jewish. That's a thing of the past. Once they're forcibly converted, then they either remain slaves or they become full-fledged Jews.
Who's to guarantee that they stay full-fledged Jews?
That's correct. That's why, as the Torah is about to tell us, you're not supposed to free them.
I think they set it up because we're not supposed to have them.
That could also be, but except the Torah doesn't seem to say it that way. That you're not supposed to free them. They're supposed to remain as slaves. Now we have examples of slaves that broke free from slavery, but that doesn't change their status. They still are technically slaves. So one example of that is Herodus, Herod. Herod was a slave. He was a non-Jew who became a slave, and his status was slave. He remained a slave even though he broke free, but he never was formally freed. Therefore, he was always a slave. That was his status. That we do have examples of slaves that were freed and they became full-fledged Jews. But that is not the default. The default is they remain as slaves. So we're going to read that right now in the Torah. So, the Torah says, Pasuk Mem Gimel, verse 43, Ve'avdecha v'amascha ashen yulach, your male slave and your female slave that you have, me'ez ha'goyim, from the non-Jews, from the nations, asher siviv osechem, that live around you, not the ones living in Israel, because the ones living in Israel you have to kill. So these are the ones not living in Israel. Mehem tiknu ebed ve'ama. From them you may purchase a male or female slave. V'gam mibnei atoshavim hagarim imachem. And also from the children of those who dwell amongst you in Israel. Mehem tiknu, from them you may buy. See, the Torah here is explaining as follows. We know the rule is lo sechaya kol neshama. When the Jews conquered Eretz Yisrael, they were required to kill out all of the non-Jews living there. The non-Jews living there, meaning the non-Jews that belong to the seven nations of Canaan. The Jews had to kill them. What happens if you have a non-Jew from a different nation who happens to be living in Canaan, even married to a Canaanite woman? That man would not need to be killed. Only those who were from the Canaanite nations had to be killed. So if you have people from other nations who happen to be living in Israel, so from them you can buy slaves. Umishpachtam ashrayimachem, from their families that are with you, asher hulidu ba'artzachem, they gave birth in your land. They shall be for you as an ancestral heritage. You can keep them.
How did they know?
That's a good question.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Walk up to you. I'm going to kill you, but are you a... Cannot...
No, I'm not one of them.
What do you mean? They checked their social security numbers.
I'm from the other side.
Okay.
I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. It's a good question.
Right.
It's a good question. Now, what happens with these slaves? V'iznachaltem osam livnechem achareichem. You shall hold on to them for your children after you. Lareshes achuza, to inherit as an inheritance. Leolam bohem ta'avodu, you shall work them forever. Meaning, you should not let them go free. Uva'achechem b'nei Yisrael ish be'achiv, but with your brothers, the b'nei Yisrael, each man with his brother, lo sir devo v'farach, you may not work them in a with hard labor. So it's only the non-Jewish slaves that you're required to keep, whereas the Jewish slaves, you cannot work them in certain ways, you can't give them hard labor, etc. So you have limitations on what you can do with the Jewish slaves, but not with the non-Jewish slaves.
So did this end when we went into exile?
Well, yeah, I mean, there were still Jewish slaves. Jewish slaves, for sure there were, because the Romans took Jewish slaves. But non-Jewish slaves, as Jews rose to prominence, they could buy a slave, like anybody else. But the process was different, obviously, and if you weren't living in a Torah land, which we weren't anymore, then you couldn't really follow it to forcibly convert or do things like that. So then it was just the regular slavery like you had everywhere else. Now, the Jewish and non-Jewish slaves that we learned about over here, and again we spoke about in Parashas Mishpatim, so often people want to know, we talked about this back then, what rights do they have? Because that's another, really a defining status of slavery is, do they have any rights? So we already have significant limitations on how much you're allowed to work and what types of work you can give to a Jewish slave. What about a non-Jewish slave? A non-Jewish slave, you are allowed to work them differently than an employee. A non-Jewish slave, you can give them slave work. You can give them menial labor. You can give them hard labor. You can give them busy work. There's no limitations like that on non-Jewish slaves. But that's not really the question. The real question is, do they have any rights? Because typically a slave nation, when you have a slave society, then they don't have any rights. So that means that the master can beat them, the master can molest them, and they have no way of protecting themselves because they have no rights. And that's really the main point about a slave. What can they appeal to any court of law for protection if they are not treated properly? So the answer to that is that we do protect the slaves, and they do have rights. The Torah itself tells us in Parashas Mishpatim that if a master, certainly if the master will kill his slave, then the master can be put to death for killing a slave, just like for killing a non-slave, can be put to death depending on the circumstances. The circumstances are a little bit different than with a free person, but still, there is the death penalty for killing a slave. But even without that, even permanently maiming a slave can result in punishment. The Torah tells us back in Parashas Mishpatim that if a master shall knock out the tooth of a slave or blind the eye of a slave, then that slave goes free. That's a very significant loss of money for the master. So clearly the Torah is telling the master that you need to be measured in how you discipline your slave. Because if you discipline your slave too harshly, that slave is going to end up going free. And you're not going to get any money for it. So even though a non-Jewish slave is not accorded the same level of protection as a Jewish slave, and doesn't have the same rights as a Jewish slave, however, we have always been far, far ahead of other slave laws, other slave nations. We've always been far ahead, that the way we treated non-Jewish slaves is always far better than the way they would be treated in other countries, in other societies, under other religions. ours are always well protected based on the law. Now, what about letting a slave go free? So the Torah is telling us here you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to let a slave go free. He's supposed to remain a slave forever. But the Torah does prescribe a manner in which you can let the slave go free. The way that a slave goes free is actually very similar to the way that a couple gets divorced. Meaning, just as when a couple gets divorced, the husband gives the wife a document, and the document states that you are now permitted to every man, he essentially sends her away from him. When it comes to slavery, it's the same type of thing. There is a document called a get shichrur, which is a document of emancipation, in which the document states that you are now your own, you're in charge of yourself. You no longer belong to an owner. So there is a way to do it. There's a method of letting a slave go free. So if the Torah here says, don't let slaves go free, yet the Torah prescribes a manner in which it can be done, there must be a circumstance or a situation in which it is either okay or perhaps even a mitzvah to let the slave go free. So we have a couple of examples of this. One predates Matan Torah, therefore it's questionable how much we can learn from it, but the Medrash tells us that Eliezer, the slave of Avraham, was a faithful slave, and he ended up bringing back Rivka for Yitzchak to marry. The Medrash says when Eliezer was faithful in the shidduch of Yitzchak, then Avraham freed him. Seems like it was a reward or an acknowledgement of Eliezer's righteousness in freeing him. So that's an example where we have somebody freeing a slave. Again, that's before the Torah was given, so it's questionable how much we can learn from that story, but there we do have that example.
So if it comes about that you can or want to let a slave go, is this now a Jewish person because it's been to mikveh and
yes,
have the brit?
Yeah, they would become Jews, regular Jews. Okay. Now the Gemara tells us a story in which Rabbi Eliezer, interesting, same person's name, Rabbi Eliezer, but this is the Tana, the sage Rabbi Eliezer, once came to Shul, and there weren't enough people for a minyan. They were short for a minyan. So he freed his slave on the spot in order to make a minyan. Because a slave can't be counted towards a minyan, but once he's free, he can be counted towards a minyan, just like any other convert. And therefore, he freed the slave to create a minyan. This is discussed extensively. Obviously, that's a good enough excuse. Why is it a good enough excuse? Why is that a valid reason to free a slave? But we do find a precedent that a slave was freed in order to perform a mitzvah of davening with a minyan. It's just noteworthy. That's a very expensive way to get a minyan. There's a man that sometimes comes to Atlanta for business. And this man never misses minyan. He's been very careful with minyan for years and years and years and never misses minyan. So there are times when he's at the airport and his business or whatever reason why he's in Atlanta only requires him to be in the airport area or downtown. Does not require him to be up in this area, and yet he will always come up to this area in order to catch a minyan. Many times he has done so, but it has not been at a time when there is a minyan. It's a time when one could daven, but it is not a time when there is a minyan going on. There's no mincha, for example. His time frame is, let's say, from 3 p.m. until 6 p.m., and there's no mincha during that time in the middle of the summer, and he's looking for a minyan. He's close to Rabbi Hiller, and what he has done in the past is he has sent Rabbi Hiller money, told him to buy pizza and gather some young men together for a minyan, and the pizza being the incentive. Right. So he's willing to spend whatever money it costs.
Really fantastic.
Yeah, whatever money it costs in order to be able to have a minion. He's always done it. He's always very careful to have a minion. So that's a nice thing. It's a beautiful thing. Here, Rabbi Eliezer freed a slave. That's thousands and thousands of dollars that he gave up in order to have a minion. One minion. Not even multiple minions, but one minion. So the importance of a minion is obviously highlighted there.
Oh, but we were on the train. Remember when the men, because it was in Israel, came walking through, I need to make a minion. I need to stab people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was wonderful.
So you see the importance of having a minion. But that begs the question, why was it permissible to free a slave? If the Torah says don't free slaves, so good. So you have one mitzvah, which you're solving, but you're compromising a different mitzvah, right? You're getting the mitzvah of having the minion, but you're compromising the other mitzvah of not freeing the slave. So how can one do that? So this touches off a whole discussion, and evidently, in order to have a minion, becomes an exception to this rule. So there are times when it is acceptable to free a slave, but not on a whim, not just because you feel like it or not. Whatever it is, the default is you keep the slaves. But there can be situations where a slave can be freed and it is acceptable to free the slave.
So in that case, does he have to have the document first? Or is just the verbal says, you're free?
He has to have the document.
So, like on the spot, you just grab these three other guys in the minion.
You only need two. Yeah. Rabbi Eliezer apparently did it right on the spot. That's apparently what he did.
But freeing him doesn't make him a Jew.
It does.
Oh, it does.
Because since he was forcibly converted as a slave, when he's freed, he's now Jewish.
Even though he hasn't been circumcised?
He was circumcised before.
Ah,
the okay. Forcible conversion as a slave included circumcision and the mikvah.
Okay.
But it only made him into a slave. It did not make him into a full-fledged Jew until he is freed. Then he becomes a full-fledged Jew.
He created the original loophole.
Right. So that's how it works with slavery. Now, I should make sure I covered every point over here that we were going to cover. The Jewish slave, as we mentioned, has a wife, perhaps has children. If you purchase him, then you are required to feed his wife and children. The non-Jewish slave, it doesn't work that way. The non-Jewish slave is just a regular non-Jewish slave, the way we always picture a slave. Right, but one cannot molest or mistreat this. Right, so that's the point that we're going to make. Thank you. So a slave society in every country, in every society where there's been there's been slavery that is completely condoned, then the slave they're always the lowest level in the totem pole, always lowest level in the caste system, and they are always mistreated and molested, etc. That's the default of slavery, as we were in Mitzrayim. We were mistreated very, very badly. Beaten, kids killed. It was we didn't have any rights. We could not protect ourselves. Hashem did protect us in Mitzrayim, as we learned before. He protected our women, that our women were not molested by the Egyptian men. But that is an anomaly. Typically, under slavery, the women are always molested because they have no rights. And when there's no rights, what is to stop the owners from doing whatever they wish? So we were protected from that in Mitzrayim, but that was miraculous. Jews who own slaves, who own these non-Jewish slaves who are now that kind of in-between status, they do have rights. As we mentioned, they're protected in the way that they are disciplined, that the owner has to be careful. But they have other rights as well. it is strictly prohibited for a Jew to have a physical relationship with his female slaves. That is prohibited. Just as it is prohibited for a Jew to have a relationship with a non-Jewish woman, it is also prohibited to have a relationship with a non-Jewish slave woman. The only exception being the Jewish slave who can be forced to have a relationship with a non-Jewish slave woman. But the owner cannot. Therefore, if the owner would cross that line, he can be taken to court. And even the slave can take him to court. And they did have rights when it came to those sorts of things. Now, I'm not trying to paint a picture in which slavery was a beautiful state to be in. After all, a person is still working, and a person has no freedom. They have no choice. They can't choose where to go and what to eat and things of that nature. They lose their autonomy. However, they were very, very much protected, far more so than the typical slavery that we are familiar with and that went on all over the globe in the time that we're discussing right now. The other point that should be clear is that how does this slave eat? Where does he get his food from? He's not drawing a paycheck, so where does he get his food from? So the slave is sustained by the master. The master is required to feed and clothe and house his slaves. In the event that the master does not do so, this slave, under certain circumstances, would be entitled to tzedakah, because otherwise they're going to die. They need food. They need shelter. They need clothing. So here again, the slave would be entitled to certain protections that is unheard of in slavery throughout the globe. It's a totally different approach to slavery that we have here than what you find elsewhere. Okay, so that concludes this paragraph and brings us to the next thing. We're a little bit early, but we are going to stop here for tonight. The next paragraph is going to cover a Jew who becomes more destitute, and what happens if that Jew sells himself to a non-Jew. Now that's a new category which we have not dealt with. We've dealt with a Jew owning a Jew. We talked about a Jew owning a non-Jew. What happens when the Jew is owned by a non-Jew? That's a new category which, please God, we'll talk about next time. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.